What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Jill Ion. Jill is a poet and a visual artist. She's a psychiatric survivor, and she has worked as a legal advocate for abused children and as a forensic medium for law enforcement and in the private sector. Jill's new book of poetry is titled Soft Outspoken. So welcome to Madness Radio, Jill Ion.
Thank you.
Jill, I'm really interested in having you on the show, both because you're a fantastic poet. Your new book, Soft Outspoken, really speaks from a very strong survivor standpoint about facing both psychiatric abuse and also gender violence. And I'm also interested in your voice hearing because you are a forensic medium, which means that law enforcement and people in society hire you because of your voice hearing gift. Is that right?
Yes.
How does that work? What does it mean to be a forensic medium?
I connect with the spirit of an individual who oftentimes has passed out of the world. So they are no longer embodied in the physical realm. They're no longer on earth as human beings. They've died and they exist in the spirit realms. And so I connect with their spirit and are able to communicate with their spirit to find out details about their passing, how they passed, where their bodies might be located, who was involved in their disappearance, their murders, and the circumstances around their deaths. I work solely in that area. People who are missing and with suspicious death and homicide cases. I don't do kind of general mediumship where people would like to connect with their relatives or loved ones who have passed. I only work with professionals in the area to find out those particular details about their passing and about where to locate their bodies once they have passed, if that is unknown in the case.
And you have this capacity and it's so solid in you that actually you are hired by law enforcement because you produce results. You're actually able to get verifiable information out of your mediumship gift.
Right. And oftentimes law enforcement, when law enforcement doesn't have any information, for example, the first real time that I ever experienced this gift in the way that I use it now is when I was about 19. I was in college. And my neighbor, I was living in a house off campus, and one of my neighbors disappeared. And I knew immediately when I heard about his disappearance what had happened. I knew that he had been murdered. And later on, it came out, they discovered his body and learned more about the circumstances of his death. And I realized that I was correct about that.
So you didn't have any direct knowledge, but you just knew through your mediumship ability.
Correct. About 10 years later, and a young man in my town went missing. And there were pictures of him around town. And I didn't know him while he was alive. I didn't recognize him, even though I lived in a very small town. But I took one of the flyers home with me. And I was very worried about him. I was very worried about the fact that he had gone missing.
So you had kind of an emotional connection, even though you didn't know him.
Yes, it worried me that he was missing. So I wanted to do something to help, but I didn't actually know that this was a capacity that I had. I did have that early experience, but I didn't share it with anyone, and I didn't really remember that experience that I had had. But I went home and I sat down and I tried to connect with his spirit. Sounds a little bit out there because I didn't have a teacher, a formal teacher. I'd never taken classes in mediumship or anything. But I realized that I could connect with his spirit and I could hear him speaking to me. And so I wrote down everything he told me about how he had died and what the circumstances were surrounding that. And I contacted law enforcement. I went to them and, well, they responded to me and they told me that they wanted to speak to me. And at first, when I spoke to them, I didn't really know how to communicate with them about what I knew. They asked me how I knew what I knew about his death. And I wasn't sure exactly how to explain that to them. I didn't really have a handle on how to communicate the experience. And they were skeptical of me, to put it mildly. They weren't quite sure what to make of me, and they seemed to think that I was connected to the disappearance in some way, that I knew that I knew someone who was responsible for his disappearance directly, even though I assured them that I did not. And soon after that, a detective who was working on the case, who had gone through the case file and found my notes, and he was working in conjunction with the prosecutor at that time. And from what I understood later, the head prosecutor was someone who really believed in the power of mediums and the mediumship, people who had mediumship ability, that we could be helpful and that it was a real skill that they could use. And so they contacted me and asked me if I would help them work on the case. And I told them that I was willing to help them with the case if they did not consider me a suspect.
Right, right.
And I assured them again that I didn't know the individual in life and I didn't know anybody associated with his disappearance or his murder. But they didn't have any information about what had happened to him or where he was. And so they were in the dark and they wanted to see me work. So they wouldn't allow me to kind of work in my own space and bring them the information. I had to sit down with them in a conference room and do the mediumship in front of them. And for someone who hadn't worked as a medium before and certainly hadn't worked as a forensic medium, this was a lot of pressure. I didn't know what I was doing exactly. So that's how I started as a forensic medium. An important part of this story is several years before that, I took a trip to India. I was there for 6 months and I was studying Buddhism. And I had this idea since I was a child that I wanted to become a Buddhist nun. So I was there kind of exploring that idea and asking permission that you have to get to become ordained in that tradition, Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And I encountered Rinpoche, who is the holder of two lineages in Tibetan Buddhism. His name is Ayang Rinpoche. When I sat down with him and I told him about some of my experiences and some of what was going on with me, he gave me a piece of information that was very, very valuable and that was valuable in my withdrawal from psychiatric medication. But it was also very valuable in having the courage to try and reach out to this missing boy when I found his flyer in town, was that I had abilities that I didn't know that I had yet. But as I got older, I would discover those abilities. They would be uncovered.
This is what the Rinpoche told you.
Correct. And he told me that I was a Dakini and that I had incarnated from another realm, spiritual realm, into this lifetime on purpose for a reason, and that this gave me these abilities. I had been developing these abilities for many, many lifetimes. He said, you can become a nun if you want to, but you don't need to do that because you don't need to take that route. You have already been in that role for many, many lifetimes in the past. This is how part of how you gained the spiritual insight and the abilities that you have now. So as you get older, you're going to discover that you have abilities that you don't know that you have yet. I didn't know what he meant by that. I wasn't sure exactly what kind of abilities he was speaking of. One of the things that was important about that meeting and about that information is that this idea of other spiritual realms existing and that we can incarnate into this realm of being and have these kinds of abilities that are very, very useful and that are indicators of spiritual insight is not an idea that exists in the mainstream culture here. And so when I discovered that I had the abilities that I have, I didn't go to the doctor and complain about the symptoms that I was experiencing because I didn't think about them as symptoms. I had that context that he had given me. He gave me a kind of a story, a way of thinking about voice hearing that I didn't get from this culture. I got from him.
And Jill, you've said a number of times about connecting with the ancestors and hearing the ancestors and the ancestors talking to you. So for people who don't have that experience, what is that like?
That's a great question. When I was a little girl, before I knew that I was a medium, I would be alone at night in my bedroom and I would feel the presence of people around me that I couldn't see. I thought maybe they were ghosts, but I wasn't quite sure what was happening. That's one way.
And when you say feel the presence, I mean, was it, how is that happening in your body? Is it sort of a, are you seeing something or is it just a sense of like, oh, someone is here with me? Are you hearing them? Or
when the lights are off and someone who is someone human, embodied in the physical realm, walks into the room, even though it's dark, you can't see them, you do know that they're there, usually. And the reason that you know is because, number one, they are there. And you don't need to see someone there to know that they're there, because there's a sense that there's another being in the room with you that you can't see. You just know that there is someone else there. That's what it's like. That was what it was like when I was a little girl. When I was in college, the first experience I ever had of voice hearing was I was in the shower and I was a resident advisor. So I was there between semesters and there weren't any other students in the residence hall. There wasn't anyone in the residence hall. And I was taking a shower. I was thinking about a friend of mine who lived a couple of hours away in another city. And all of a sudden, I heard a very loud voice coming from another part of the bathroom. I looked out the bathroom stall to see if anyone was there because it sounded human. It sounded like a human's voice. It was a little bit too loud to be a human's voice unless the human was shouting at me. But I was startled. I was terrified. And I wasn't sure what just happened. The voice told me that my friend was going to be coming into town that week in a couple of days. So the spirit knew what I was thinking, and it was giving me information that I didn't have yet. It turns out what was interesting was my friend did not come into town that week, and I thought, wow, not only am I hearing voices, but those voices aren't giving me correct information. This is not good. This is not a good sign. But actually, when about a week later, I learned that he was planning on coming. When my guide told me that, he was planning on coming into town. So it was correct in the moment that he gave me the information, which was a great lesson, spiritual lesson for me. But he had to postpone the trip because of something else that came up. And so he actually came into town the following week. And at the time, I went to a medium that I knew in town and I said, told her what had happened. And she kind of shrugged and said, well, yeah, that's kind of normal thing. Like, that's what happens to mediums, right? Like, she was very nonchalant about this experience. So that's a one way that we can hear our ancestors and hear our guides is as disembodied voices that sound like they're human. But that was the only time that I've ever heard a voice like quite like that with that quality. Generally, when I hear my ancestors and I communicate with spirits, like in my mediumship work as a forensic medium, they communicate with me internally as an internal voice. And so they sound like a thought sounds when I think it. Now, sometimes it's a little bit tricky to discern what is my thought and what is a voice that I'm hearing. But generally, they speak to me in a voice that has a different quality than my own voice. This was before the boy went missing in my town. I think it was the same year that the boy went missing. I asked my guides to show me, to give me a sign whether or not I was actually doing this. Was this a real phenomenon? And one morning I woke up and I started hearing a voice inside my mind telling me to turn on the television. Now, I had just woken up and I didn't want to turn on the television. I had no reason to turn on the television, but it wouldn't leave me alone. It kept repeating the same phrase, turn on the television. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I'll turn on the television later. And it kept telling me to turn on the television. So finally I got up and I turned on the television, and it was the morning of 9/11. And every single station had the same cameras trained on the World Trade Center. And I thought, oh, I had asked you for a sign that I would not be able to deny. And you gave it to me. Thank you for that sign. Oftentimes I hear my ancestors speaking to me through thoughts. They speak to me through a sensation that I have in my body of knowing. They communicate with me through images that come to me.
For you, you're very exceptional in the sense that you have this external validation of having police forces hiring you. And so what are some examples of times maybe when you've been able to demonstrate that, yes, this isn't just some imaginal belief I'm coming up with. This is actually real access to real information that can actually be useful to law enforcement.
I have a client who comes to me, or on that first occasion when I reached out to law enforcement when that boy went missing.
Mm-hmm. Was there any information that came out about that that was helpful?
When I sat down with them, they had no information. So we were sitting down as two parties. I was sitting down with the prosecutor and with the detective, and they were taking notes, and I was demonstrating mediumship. It was the first time I ever did that with anyone. I didn't know that I could do that until I sat down with them on this case, even though I had had some experiences that I hadn't shared with other people. And so the boy who had gone missing, who he had been murdered, he was there with us in spirit. And he was communicating with me about the questions that they needed answers to, like, how was he murdered? Who was he murdered by? You know, where did this happen? Where is his body now? And so he showed me and told me the information. Now, when I was conveying that information, not only was this process a relatively new process for me, but I didn't know if the information I was getting was accurate or not, because I was trusting the information that he was giving me, but I couldn't verify it myself either. So when I gave it to them, I didn't know if it was correct, and they didn't know if it was correct. But once they found the individual who was responsible and he confessed, they found the body, then they knew that the information that I had given them was accurate. It was about at least 90% accurate.
And that's just one example of how you've been helping law enforcement with your mediumship. Is there another example you'd like to share with us?
Several years ago, before I came off of the medication, while I was still on the medication, I did still have some connection to the spirit realm and could communicate to some degree with the spirit realm. And I was able to do the work, even though it wasn't on a consistent basis and as a consistent basis as I would like to do it in the future. But there was a case in North Carolina that where a child named Zara Baker went missing. I believe it was in Hickory, North Carolina. And I knew when I heard the coverage of that case that I could help with that case. And so I contacted law enforcement in Hickory, and they asked one of their officers to contact me and put him, assign him to maintain contact with me. So I worked with them on that case, on the Zahra Baker case. That received international coverage because, well, it was a child that went missing. Her mother murdered her. Her stepmother did.
Oh my God.
So it's interesting that, you know, my own history of violence and trauma as a crime victim helps me to understand and to connect with victims in the spirit realm. That is one gift, I believe, of the experience of those traumas that I endured, was that it gives me a very deep connection and a way of, I have an affinity to those victims because of what they endured. And so it's very easy for me to identify with them and to form relationships with them because of the shared experience that we have. Seeing things that other people don't see and hearing things that other people don't hear, to take the language of the psychiatric evaluation, the idea that those experiences are symptoms of mental illness, and yet law enforcement agencies in this country and the military are using people's skills that are identical because they are another way of knowing, because they fill in blanks that are necessary to be a more full picture. The idea that these are symptoms of mental illness sounds more to me like these are unsanctioned ways of knowing. These are unsanctioned ways of gaining insight that allow people, certain people, to have authority and be considered authorities, and other people to be considered marginalized in some cases. In other cases, those skills and abilities are seen as very valuable and are able to give insight and are worthy of being paid for. They're the identical experiences. So what is really going on here?
Yeah.
I think this is a great question.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
So
people who are listening may notice that you have an accent, and it's a Trinidad accent. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that, because that's kind of where the story starts. And I want to find out more about how you did end up in psychiatry.
The experience of moving to this country and encountering this culture was a very difficult one. It was difficult. And it was traumatic. The experience of an immigrant in this country is always of an outsider. No matter how long you live here, you always maintain the perspective of an outsider. And a lot of the culture is not welcoming of you, and you're very aware of that, even as a young child. So I had a very difficult time. When I was first put on to medication, I was in Trinidad. I was studying in college in this country, in the US. And I went back to Trinidad to study just before I graduated from college, because at my college we had we would study on campus for one or two semesters, and then we'd go somewhere else for one or two semesters and then come back to the campus. So at that point, I was off campus doing something different, and I was in Trinidad. And I was having some problems with my digestive system. And so I was getting nauseous, and my food doesn't seem to be digesting properly. So my father suggested I see a doctor, and I went to see a doctor of internal medicine down in Trinidad, and he didn't check me out at all. He didn't listen to my heart with his stethoscope or look on my tongue, or my tongue, look in my mouth or anything. He just talked to me, and he asked me what else was going on in my life. And I told him that I had been raped a few years before and that that was still affecting me. And while I was talking to him about that, I got very upset about that, the fact that I had been raped and that experience, and I started to cry. And he told me that he thought that I was really suffering from anxiety and depression and that I needed to see a psychiatrist, which I thought was a terrible idea at the time. I couldn't believe that he thought I needed to see a psychiatrist. Obviously, this was a digestive issue and there was something else going on, but it wasn't a psychiatric issue. So he gave me two prescriptions. One was actually one prescription for Xanax. And I didn't fill this prescription because I was terrified of this whole idea that I was being prescribed medication for anxiety and he wanted me to see a psychiatrist. What was he thinking? I went to this place in Trinidad called the Savannah. It's kind of a park. And I remember sitting in the Savannah and crying. It felt like a death to me. It felt like something had big had just happened.
Because he had kind of ignored your physical problem and had gone right to you need medications for anxiety.
Yes, exactly. And what is this about a psychiatrist? I am not a person who needs to see a psychiatrist. The symptoms continued, and I eventually went to the pharmacy and I filled the prescription for Xanax. And when I filled the prescription for Xanax and I took the Xanax, wow, it was like, I felt so calm. I felt
There's a reason why the benzodiazepines are sold for recreational drug purposes, is they get you high. I mean, they can feel really great to be on them for some people.
Absolutely. I thought, oh, he must be absolutely right. This medication is so useful. It's so helpful. Maybe he's brilliant. Right about the other stuff too.
Yeah, brilliant. Here's my solution. Yeah, it feels so good. So
right. This is like a genetic problem that sometimes rears its head. And so I started thinking, well, maybe he's right about the other things too. Maybe I do need to go and see a psychiatrist.
Were you also given the message about chemical imbalances and there's something in your brain that's out of whack? Or
absolutely, yes. And when I went to the psychiatrist, you know, it was this very kind woman who was a professor in the college there, and she was very intelligent, and she explained to me all about the chemical imbalance and the genetic disposition. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll try this and see, even though my intuition was telling me, do not take this medication. Don't do this. The authority of these people, I really bought into their authority and their medical opinions. And I thought, maybe I really need to listen to these people. Maybe they're right. And so she wrote me a prescription for Prozac. And eventually I took the Prozac and I thought, wow, this is incredible. I had always been a very shy, quiet kind of a person. And all of a sudden I didn't have the social anxiety that I had before. I had this like disinhibiting.
People have even compared Prozac and some of the antidepressants to mild forms of cocaine, that suddenly you have this extroverted, energized, confident, overconfident side that can come in, and they underestimate that. Yeah, it's a drug that's getting you high.
Yes. And that was my experience. I had stayed away from recreational drug use because, and it's so interesting, is because I knew how sensitive my nature was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was afraid that if I were to take any of those drugs, that it would really throw me off in one direction or the other.
So your instincts, your intuition is in the right direction of caution, but there's something about, it's very hard for people to really face this, that someone can be a very intelligent, very thoughtful, highly educated doctor, very caring, very concerned, very knowledgeable, and be completely wrong about something as huge as what's going on in the mind and the nature of medications and what they're doing in their practice and whether they're actually going to be risking harming people instead of helping them. And it's a little mind-boggling when you face that in someone, that they have so much authority, so much confidence, so much intelligence, so much knowledge, and they're just totally wrong. And you cannot trust them because they're going to lead you in the wrong direction. That's it's a hugely shocking thing to people to face that in society and to have to come out of it. And it sounds like you just fell right into it. Fortunately, you were able to come out of it later, but at the time, now did you started taking the Xanax and the Prozac, is that right?
And the Prozac. And I realized this is really doing something for me that is giving me energy. I feel very vibrant. When I looked out of myself, it felt like the colors were much more vibrant. The world felt more alive. I felt more alive in the world. I thought, is this how other people feel in the world? Because I've been missing something.
You're reminding me of my first Prozac experience, which led reaction. I was in a very wild, altered state. And it was like an amplification. It was like everything just got dialed up. Everything was more vibrant. I had so much more energy. Of course, it didn't last. But the belief that I had at the time was, oh, I have been impaired. I have this chemical imbalance. Something is wrong with me that the drug is fixing. You know, I'm finally getting the treatment that I need. And it sounds like the doctor didn't give you any sense of the risks or how to understand your experience or to see things in any kind of honest way with what was happening to you. So you just completely fell into it of, this is my solution. This is what I need.
Yes. And it's interesting because it was in the early 90s when I was raped at college. And when that happened, I went to see the university physician and I was having a very powerful trauma reaction. And he said to me, I was terrified by the way that my psyche and the way that my body had changed after the rape and the new experience I was having in the world.
What were some of the changes?
My memory had been impaired. I couldn't sleep. I was terrified all the time. I felt a very deep sense of betrayal because the person who raped me was a close friend of mine.
Mm, wow.
And at the time, the university physician said to me, I am not going to put you on medication. This is not an illness. This is a reaction to what has just happened. And I thought, who is this man telling me that he won't give me something, give me a solution, give me a medication to help me cope with this terrible experience that I'm having? Who is this person who is refusing to do this?
Right.
What is
right.
Wrong
you're supposed
with
to
him?
Help me. Yeah, you're supposed to help me. Where's
supposed
the pill?
You're supposed to be on my side. And right now you're telling me you're not. You absolutely refuse to give me any type of medication. Later, he was absolutely right about that. But at the time, my reaction to that was, how dare you? How dare you withhold this solution from me? So, you know, it's funny because later on, after I had been on the medication for a long time. And as time went on, I became more and more ill.
Did you stay on just the Xanax or the Prozac
Because then I started having more problems sleeping at that point. And then I needed a third medication to help me sleep because the other medications were creating.
Right. They were creating sleep problems, and then they just give you more pills to treat the side effects of the other pills.
Right. But what they told me was that sleep insomnia can be an issue for people with depression.
Right. They blamed your disease rather than looking at the side effects of the medication.
Exactly. And so I was a true believer after that initial experience I had on that medication. I swallowed the whole story, hook, line, and sinker. I thought, these people know what they're doing.
Right, which is very dangerous in some situations with psychiatry. And then did you end up taking even more medication than just the three?
Yes, I ended up actually being prescribed 7 medications.
7 medications at the same time.
Right. And when I was...
Just on the face of that, that is clearly malpractice. That is horrific. And at the same time, it happens to many, many people. So that must have included like antipsychotics or bipolar medications or mood stabilizers or something like that.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Some people have described this as going down the rabbit hole. You take one med and then you have side effects, and then they give you another med for that. And then pretty soon you're on multiple medications, all under the lie, really, that it's your disease and not the medications that are causing it.
Yes.
And also a betrayal, because I mean, your first experience with the rape is a betrayal of someone you trust. And now you're stepping into another situation where you're trusting someone who's ending up betraying you. So it's an additional re-traumatization of a survivor when that happens.
Yes. But it's not just the doctors as individuals, it's this whole system, this whole belief that we have been indoctrinated into in this culture, that we have chemical imbalances that can be fixed with these medications, and that the experiences we're having of the world and of the things that we've endured are not normal. They're not normal reactions. And we need this chemical to help us cope.
So this is one of the things that you've written so strongly about in your poetry, your process of coming out of that true believer position. Do you want to maybe read one of the poems from your new collection of poetry that speaks to this? I would love to hear you read Fuck the DSM, but we might have some censorship issues. Okay. We do go out on a FM radio station in Oregon. So
this poem is called Dear Psychiatry. It's one of the first poems that I wrote when I started writing again. I discovered when I was on the medication that even though I was trained as an artist and have a degree in visual art, I stopped making art and writing creatively while I was on the medication. Hmm. When I came off of the medication, all of that came back. So I started wanting to write creatively again and make art again, and I started doing those things. Even though I hadn't written creatively for about 16 years.
16 years. So you were on medications for a long time.
For 16 years, yes. 16 wow. years. So this is one of the poems that I wrote, one of the first poems that I wrote when I started writing again.
Yeah, please. And I want to hear also about your coming off medications process too, but please go ahead.
I ground down in myself, the one I thought had gone the way of all things, when I paid for your stories to help make sense of my pain. Those days I washed up on your shore, I was trying to put myself back together, when your therapy rearranged me, and then your medicine destroyed me. I paid for your philosophy. I paid you to help me. I paid you with my life. You told me you could help, that the pills would, and then you drained my life out slowly over the next 16 years. Well, I returned home to myself, unmedicated, and found an answer I sought with you all those years you called me sick, when I was already whole. The effects of your pills poured cement over my self-authority until I pried off the heavy glass layered between access to a full range of emotions, memory, my identity, without your permission. Now I am reclaiming ground. I sat across from you in that English racing green leather chair with brass rivets and said no. It sounded like silence when that was all I could afford. Your patient's best interests get in the way of profits when health is what you reap instead of sow. Now your white coats and fancy medical degrees are in my wake as I hit the ground and run for my life, because the only way back to myself is away from you and the cage you filled pill bottles with. Incarceration through diagnostic code. UMD, UDO, UCID. You purveyors of poison for profit. You who use Jupiter and his symbol to represent the reward. You decimated me with chemical-infused Trojan horses. Make no mistake, my womb doesn't wander. Research this. Barely 4 months off your medicine, my life force flooded back with a vengeance that transcends your diagnostic criteria and control. I surrendered to my own body's ability to heal itself, ground into what you call fundamentally flawed, said was wrong in as many ways as you could fill your textbooks and history. Whatever you do, don't stop taking your medication, you said, after the Prozac and the Paxil and the Buspar and the Klonopin and the Xanax and the Brintellix and the Trazodone and the Zoloft and the Protriptyline and the Lamictal, after the Hydroxyzine and the Cymbalta and the Celexa. All this time, you claim to do no harm. I backed up, told you to back off. I withdrew and finally found the answer on my own without you, who were no solution. Your kindness and good intentions aren't enough when you do harm psychiatry.
Do you feel there's a parallel between surviving this violation by psychiatry and also surviving the gender violence, the sexual violence that you've been through in that whole recovery process? Because both of those voices are woven together in your collection of poetry.
Yes, I do. For me, recovering from the withdrawal and from the years of being poisoned by that medication was much more difficult, taking my power back from that. I think because in the culture, there is not yet an understanding of the harms that these medications are doing. And so to find my strength and to find my voice took me so much longer to do. But also in the withdrawal process, what I've found is that all of the previous trauma that I had endured all came up, surfaced, and I had to reprocess it during the withdrawal process. And that was brutal. It was so difficult. And I had to do it mostly alone. My doctors didn't know how to help me during the withdrawal process. And I've heard from a lot of people who are able to leave their doctors and see Chinese doctors or functional medicine doctors who can afford to see those kinds of doctors. I was not able to do that. And so what I decided to do, actually, I remember my doctor had, I was on 6 different medications, and my psychiatrist prescribed lithium to me. And I was horrified by the idea that I was being prescribed lithium. And so I decided that I was going to do some research. And he wasn't happy about that idea. He didn't like the idea that I wanted to do research because he wanted to be the authority in our relationship. And I remember him saying, you know, something along the lines of, I am the authority in this relationship. He didn't use those words, but he said to me, why do you have to become an expert on every subject? And I thought, that statement doesn't make sense to me, because this is a drug that I'm agreeing to put into my body, and this doesn't make sense to me. So yes, of course I want to do some research. But he was very uncomfortable with that idea. And I ended up taking one dose of the lithium, and my physical reaction to that, I was already on 6 other drugs. And I couldn't function at all after taking that one dose of lithium. And I thought, okay, no. There's something going on here. And underneath all of this reaction that my body and my mind were having to the medication, I could feel underneath that the self that I knew before I was put on that medication. And I thought to myself, I think the medication is making me sick. And I remember saying that to a friend of mine who had never been on this medication, but she just held space for me to say that aloud. She didn't contradict me. She didn't tell me I was wrong. She just listened. And I thought, I'm going to do something about this. And I remember sitting in front of my psychiatrist in his office. And I remember thinking to myself, I am right and you are wrong. Not just you, my psychiatrist, but all of the doctors that I am encountering, all of my doctors, all of the people in my life who believe that I need to be on this medication, all of you are wrong. And I am right. And I cannot say that to you aloud, because if I do say that to you aloud, you're going to consider that a delusion. So I'm going to keep that to myself. But I'm going to come off of this medication and I'm going to prove to you that I am right and that you are wrong. And then that is exactly what I did.
Where do you feel like that strength and that clarity came from? I mean, you had the experience of questioning the lithium, having the doctor say, no, don't do your own research, and then trying the lithium and then having your own response and having your own evidence in a sense. But where do you think that deeper strength to question and to prove them wrong really came from? And do you think that there maybe is a spiritual side to it? Because you mentioned, you know, your your medium gift and having that at a very early age and your spiritual connection?
Yes. I think that there are a few different answers to that question. One answer is a few years before I came to that understanding and that place of clarity, I met a man who is he's African American, and he was trained in an indigenous African tradition, spiritual tradition called Ifa. He's an Ifa priest, and he's a medium. And one day we were talking, and he was communicating with my ancestors. While I was on, the more and more medication that I was on, is the less able to directly communicate with the spiritual world. I didn't have that facility to the same degree as I have now since I've been off. And when I spoke to him, he said to me, "One day you are going to come off of all of this medication. And when you do, you are going to be able to communicate with your ancestors very easily. You're going to be able to hear them clearly in a way that you don't hear them now." And I nearly stopped speaking to him. I was so insulted by the idea that he thought I didn't need my medication.
Because at that point you were so strongly in the true believer position of trusting your doctors and really believing in your meds.
Exactly. I was incensed by this idea. How dare he tell me I don't need this thing that I need so deeply? I continued the relationship with him, but I put that idea and what he had said to me very far back in my mind. I forgot about it, but I think that it planted a seed in me. He was absolutely right. When I came off of the medication, I really feel as though my ancestors and my guides in the spirit realms were helping to guide me off the medication. Because I cold turkeyed seven psychiatric medications. One of those I only took once, but I was in bed after that one dose of lithium for 2 weeks. So after that, I cold turkeyed the six other drugs and I survived.
You cold turkeyed six drugs that you had been on for 16 years.
Correct. That's correct.
Including antipsychotics, benzodiazepines. So it sounds like you got some serious spiritual help from your ancestors in that.
Yes. And I felt as though they were guiding me through the process. I know that they were guiding me through the process.
I can imagine you must have been just completely incapacitated for a long time. You must have been just totally ill with the withdrawal and with the struggle and everything.
I was bedridden for 2.5 years. I live alone, and so I had to do everything myself. So while I was mostly bedridden, I still had to get up and clean my apartment and cook for myself and deal with, like, pay my bills and do all of those things.
How were you financially able to do this?
I was on disability, so I was receiving Social Security during that time. And so that's how I was managing financially.
So you're living very frugally, I imagine, very limited resources just on a disability check.
Exactly. Yes. And part of how I processed the experience that I was having, because in withdrawal, I found that I wasn't able to articulate what I was feeling or what I was experiencing. I couldn't speak up for myself. Sometimes I could, but I had a very limited capacity to do that, even when I could do that. So I began to write as a way of communicating and as a way of processing my feelings and this experience that I was having that was like no other experience I'd ever had.
What were some of the things that you went through? I mean, I can only imagine how horrendous it must have been, 16 years on six different meds. Wow.
I was very afraid to leave my apartment. My balance was bad. I couldn't walk properly. I would fall over when I would try to take a shower. I had very severe memory loss. I was emotionally very unstable. I couldn't speak clearly or articulate myself clearly, articulate my experience clearly, couldn't follow a conversation, listen to music, watch television. You know, I had been, when I graduated from high school, the college that I went to was more difficult to get into than Harvard University. The admissions process of that college was more competitive than the admissions process of Harvard University.
What college was it?
That was New College in Sarasota. So I had been reduced to this person who couldn't function and who couldn't think through very simple tasks. I couldn't figure out how to clean my bathroom or cook something that I had cooked many times before withdrawal. And so I wasn't sure that how long this experience was going to last. And like I said, I was bedridden for about 2.5 years. So during that time, I used writing as a way of processing my feelings. And I really didn't expect to share any of the writing that I did. I wasn't writing it to share it. It was simply a way of my expressing where I was. And I thought that I would be able to look back on the writing and remember where I was when I recovered.
So you were not only dealing with the withdrawal process and the physical damage that the drugs were doing to you and had done to you, you're also dealing with the incredible loss and everything that you've been through for 2 years, losing your life for 2 years and everything before that. And you're also dealing with all the trauma that you had been through is now coming back and processing that.
Exactly. Yes.
And you did all this basically alone.
Yes. I had some help here and there, and I had some important help. I had some support that really benefited me. Some people who contributed their insights to my process that were very, very beneficial.
And it sounds like your spiritual connection, your ancestors really were the source of your strength.
Yes. And I was able, because I was able to hear them so clearly and I trusted them, I allowed them to guide me. I also felt as though there was another part of me that was not part of my incarnated self in my physical body that was also guiding me. And so I think, you know, when I was first diagnosed with anxiety and depression, and I had that feeling of my intuition telling me, do not listen to what you're being told. Do not take this medication. And I allowed the medical authority that these people in front of me that I was going to for help to override that. 16 years later, I decided, you all have been wrong all these years. I was right in the beginning, and I'm right now. And instead of listening to your medical authority and to your ideas about this, I'm going to do something completely different, and I am going to listen to my own intuition now. I am going to listen to my own inner guidance and my own sense of this.
You know, you had said before that being an immigrant coming from Trinidad, it always gave you this position and this experience of being an outsider. And so in some sense, maybe I'm imagining that that actually worked to your benefit at that moment, because like, wait a second, I'm not part of you. I'm something outside of this. And then that becomes a resource.
It was a resource. It's interesting that the first doctors who prescribed those medications to me were in the context of my culture of origin. And so I trusted not only what the information that they were providing me, but I was a part of that cultural environment. So I think if I had been diagnosed with depression and anxiety initially in the United States, it would have given me a little bit more leverage in saying no.
So it actually made it harder.
It did make it harder that the people that prescribed me the medication were members of my own culture of origin. So I understand why, yeah. So it did make it more difficult. But then, you know, I had followed their advice like a religion. I took that medication exactly the way that it had been prescribed. And I did everything they told me to do to the letter. I would not adjust my own medication unless they told me it was okay. Finally, I met a psychiatrist who is the one who prescribed lithium to me, who was actually very beneficial in some ways. And one of the ways he was very beneficial to me was to say, you do not have to follow what I say to the letter. You can adjust your own medication. Let me show you how.
Now, was this the same doctor that said, don't do your own research?
Yes.
So how is it that they were both offering you some support for your independence, but at the same time telling you to not research it?
Exactly. And this is the confusion I think that I was facing was, on one hand, you're really helping me and offering me some great insight. On the other hand, you're poisoning me and you're making me very sick. And yet you're being very kind and compassionate. It's this mix of different things that are happening. It's not black and white.
Yes, which is one of the reasons that certain kinds of intimate violence are so traumatizing. Because if our partner or our close friend or our husband or wife is someone who's hurting us, then that becomes all the more traumatic because of the confusion that comes in. Because there are these good things in the relationship, but at the same time, it's absolutely violence that's happening.
Yes. And it took me making the decision internally to trust my own belief and to trust this idea that I had, this hypothesis I had that maybe it's the medication that's making me, that has made me so sick. Because I could feel myself underneath that experience still there. But then the journey off of the medication and realizing these people don't even know how to advise me to stop taking this medication. That's why I cold turkeyed it, was because I didn't know how to come off of it. I couldn't figure out how to do the research because I was so impaired. The doctors didn't know how to explain to me how to come off of it because they didn't know themselves. And then what I ended up doing was staying with those doctors. And eventually, my psychiatrist apologized to me.
You stayed in touch with them while you were doing the withdrawal process.
Yes. And he said, you were right, and I was wrong. We poisoned you. Those were the words that he used to me. He took responsibility because he could see as I was recovering, I continued to see him, even though I wasn't taking the medication. And he apologized to me and he took responsibility. My physician, who begged me not to stop taking the medication, also apologized. And she told me that I had changed the way that she practiced medicine.
Because they were so intimate, they were so connected to you, and they watched the whole process, and then you actually came out the other side. They actually saw the whole thing. That's so unusual, because so many times the story is people leave their physicians, so they disconnect, and then the doctors or the physicians, they don't hear, they don't see. But in your case, they actually had the evidence of your whole story right in front of them.
And that's one reason why I stayed in relationship with them. I stayed in the relationship because I wanted them to see what I thought would be true, which was that I would recover.
You had said that was part of your inspiration, was to prove them wrong.
Yes.
So during those two and a half years that you were in withdrawal, were there any discoveries or any kind of key learning that came out of that process of ways to do the withdrawal that maybe people might learn from? Or,
well, I think that the creative art process and the writing process were key to me, and they can be used as tools that are very useful to other people, and they can be then used as a way to communicate about what we endure. And that is what the book does.
So it was during the process, so you were expressing your emotions, but not necessarily to someone who's listening or there with you, but through your creative art process.
Exactly. And many of the pieces that I wrote were written to earlier selves. So the self that was very, very ill and didn't know what was wrong and thought that she did have this chemical imbalance and she did have this genetic inheritance that she was so unlucky to have. It was often to earlier parts of myself that I was writing. Hmm.
Would you like to share another poem or two from the collection?
Sure.
What would be a good one that maybe speaks to what we're covering here?
I'd like to read Medicine, which is about a conversation that I had with my physician when I decided to stop taking the medication. It's called Medicine. My physician apologized. She said she was sorry. She told me not to stop taking the medicine. So I leaned into the space between us in the examining room and said, "That's okay. I needed to take my power back for 16 years. You gave me the opportunity to do that. I needed to know I could trust myself. I didn't need the medicine. I am the medicine."
So on the other side of this process, having been through this incredible withdrawal and challenging the authority of the doctors and rethinking what's going on with you and who you are, do you feel like there's some kind of gift or something positive or some learning that you got out of it? Because that's an incredible loss. I mean, you've had a big chunk of your life really taken from you,
right,
by the psychiatric treatment. But is there also something that positive that came through it, do you think?
I'm not sure yet. I think that I'm still in the process of discovering that. I wish I had a better answer for you. I wish I could say, yes, this is what it is. But I'm not sure that I know what that is yet. If there is something, I don't think that I can stop the loss from being anything but a loss.
But a loss, yeah. Maybe there isn't. I mean, there could be gifts in other directions in your life. But sometimes, I mean, looking at my own life, I mean, I basically had my life interrupted for 15 years. In my career, my life, my relationships, everything was just kind of put on pause and put in a certain kind of deep freeze for those years, which I was just in this space of fear and withdrawal and disconnection. And for me, it was the identity and it was the disability check, and because I had been off medications. And I look back on that and I say, well, I mean, I think there were some gifts, but basically, no, I just have to mourn. I have to grieve that. And I have to just recognize that this is just a terrible thing that happened to me. Because I think if we rush too quickly to say, this is a gift, something positive came out of it, then it's just phony. It's a dishonest, it's like a spiritual bypass. We're not really facing the horror of it really, which is part of the grieving process. You have to really go right into it and say, and also the rage. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about your collection of poems is that your strength comes through so strongly, and your anger and your fierceness and your survival instinct, not just around the psychiatric violation, but also around the violence that has been done to you by men, and the gender violence and the rape and the abuse. And it's so important to so many of us in the healing process, the recovery process, to find a way for that anger to come out. And that comes through very strongly in your poems. Did you want to read another poem that maybe picks up that theme?
Sure.
I'm looking at one that starts, "If you think those pills,
your way home."
Your way home.
This is almost
a letter from one part of yourself to another.
Or it maybe is exactly that. That's exactly what it is. And what surprises me about, I was put some of my work up on a platform during the withdrawal process called Scriggler, was created by a Russian immigrant. I believe he might live in the UK. But as soon as I posted this poem, he made it a poem of the day, which elevates it above all of the other poems that are on that platform and spotlights that poem. And I was amazed by the fact that he did that because of what this poem speaks to. Such an important thing to have happen during that time. So this poem is called "Your Way Home." If you think those pills created more problems than they're worth, that those tablets and capsules don't treat your underlying condition, don't address your needs, that they aren't a solution, you're right. They don't. If you wonder why you're much sicker than you were before, and ask yourself how you got here to this land of doctor's appointments with a pill case jingling with promises of a solution that brought you to this place, and the men and women who agreed they were ever a treatment, you were right about them. They weren't right about you. That voice deep down that told you the truth, and when you breathed it aloud in that soft, outspoken way, or in the voice of vengeance, you earned a right to speak in, and they condemned you, and then threw you away far beyond the margins of the economy, and you hung on to the edge of a society you weren't easily enough controlled by. You were right. You are now too. All is not lost. This is an anthem. Start to reclaim yourself slowly this time, even though you want to throw it down the drain, flush it down the nearest toilet, far away from you, to remove the bottles of opportunity you might use to get the hell out of here. Try and avoid years of protracted withdrawal that might embed itself upon the trauma you've already endured. Step away from your medication regime long enough to listen to the sound of your heart singing songs of justice and believe what it tells you is true. Those medications are no treatment. And those people you trusted with the most intimate details of your life are not trustworthy. They don't have your best interests at heart, but you do. I believe you. You were right about those pills that were no solution. You are enough. Find your family of choice, your community. Learn that blood is not thicker than water. Love is thicker than blood. And you will find your way home.
Beautiful. That poem is, I think, medicine for all of us. The theme here is really finding your truth and being able to listen to what's inside of you. Well, we don't have a lot of time left, but there's one poem that, you know, so much of your work and your story is about being a survivor and standing up to sexist violence. And there's one poem I would invite you to read, the No Trespassing poem.
Sure. This poem, No Trespassing, it identifies a woman named Isabel, who is a woman who is, she's also a writer, who has survived sexual violence as a child. She did. And she had a sign in her bedroom that I refer to in the poem. So this is No Trespassing. One day I'll walk without invitations for rides, shouted by men in pickup trucks, driving in the opposite direction, straight to hell, and wait without an incessant flow of questions about my marital status and whether I've been incarcerated or not, as though that would explain why I'm not married yet. If I'm looking for a boyfriend and why not, whether I'll take their phone numbers to call them when I'm ready. Constant harassment embeds itself in me. I think I'll tattoo No Trespassing across my chest, after all, and walk with a pit bull named Happy, my body between sandwich boards that read like the sign in Isabel's bedroom did, no hunting or fishing here. Just after I was raped in college, that night, I told a friend that I was going to tattoo No Trespassing across my chest. And so that's the other reference in that poem. Thank you so much for having me, Will.
It's been wonderful. It's been so powerful. And thank you so much for being here. Maybe you'd like to mention how people can contact you and also remind us the name of your new collection of poetry and how people can get a copy.
The collection is called Soft Out Spoken. There's a Facebook page of that name. You can also contact me and find out more information about how to buy the book online. It'll be in multiple different online stores. And the website is jylanais.com.
Jill Ion, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Jill Ion. She is a poet and visual artist and also a psychiatric survivor. Jill worked as a legal advocate for abused children, and she also works as a forensic medium for law enforcement and the private sector. Her new book of poetry is Soft Outspoken. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall. Producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Madden America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at maddenamerica.com.